This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 381 was produced on June 22, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Gehring & Rosenzweig co-founder Lee Gehring returns as this week's feature interview guest. Our topic will be an update on the formative global food crisis resulting from more of the world's economies advancing to the point where far more people eat meat all over the world, putting even more demand on grains.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard Week over Week as at the close of Wednesday, June 21st, 2023. The S&P 500 was down 20 basis points to 4409. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in that post-game segment. The U.S. dollar index down 88 basis points to 102.09, consolidating along its 52-week lows. The August WTI crude oil contract up 595 basis points to 72.53. It's bouncing higher from oversold levels. We'll take a look at that chart in the postgame. Gold down 122 basis points to 19.45. This remains in consolidation. Copper up 103 basis points, closing to 391, crawling its way higher week over week. And uranium down 131 basis points to 56.65, price stalling week over week after several strong months. The 10-year treasury yield down 8 basis points, closing at 372 points. And the key news to watch this week is the European and US PMIs. And next week, we have consumer sentiment, GDP numbers, and the core PCE index. This week's feature interview guest is Lee Gehring. Eric, why did we invite Lee back on the show this week?
Well, Patrick, this is a show that I've been really excited about. I think the food crisis, the global food crisis, is probably the most underreported and least understood story that we have in finance today. Everybody's acting as if the pressures on food are short-term supply chain-related effects, when in reality, Lee Gehring has articulated a very concise argument in an interview that he did for us last summer, explaining why we're headed toward a food crisis globally. So is that now upon us? Is that really what's happening? Or are these really just transient effects and that's not really happening yet? Well, needless to say, I wanted to get an answer directly from the horse's mouth, and it's been almost a year since we had Lee on the show, so it's time to get him back on for an update.
Well, Eric's interview with Lee Gehring is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables, or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Gehring & Rosenzweig co-founder Lee Gehring. Lee, it's great to get you back on the show. For any new listeners who didn't catch your last interview, I want to start by just setting the context for everyone. We had you and your partner, Adam Rosenzweig, on the show last year. Adam predicted that there is going to be an energy crisis in coming years. You predicted that there's going to be a food inflation and food price crisis in coming years. At the time, our feeling was we thought Adam's story was the one that was more imminent, more likely to happen right away. We thought the food story was likely to play out in a longer time frame. Seems like it's going the opposite way, that the energy story hasn't happened yet. But boy, food inflation in the last 6 months has been really significant. What's driving it and why are things happening out of order?
Eric, and thanks for having me back again. And I do remember talking extensively about global agricultural markets with you. Not much has changed from the last time you and I talked. I talked about what were the factors that were going to push the world into a global agricultural, global food crisis. And what's interesting since then, a lot of that has happened. And, you know, just to step back a little bit, you know, what were those factors that we believed were going to produce maybe one, but potentially multiple food crises, agricultural crises, as we progress through this decade? And one was the fact that is that over the last 20 years, we've seen a significant ratcheting up of the demand for global grain. And the underlying fundamental reason behind that is that never before have so many people been in that notch of disposable income, which basically goes from about, you know, $500 to $1,000 per capita GDP that then goes through their expansion cycle and eventually reach $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 per capita GDP. Never have there been so many people that have been going through that period in their economic cycle. And one of the things when you go through that increase in per capita GDP, you want to change your dietary preferences. You basically want to switch from, you know, subsisting primarily on starch, which would be wheat and rice primarily, to enjoying a more animal protein-based diet. And I talked in our last interview that, you know, we had gone back and studied every emerging market economy since the late 1950s and how they had gone through this transition. And we postulated that this was the reason why global grain consumption between 1980 and 2000 basically grew at about 1.3% per year, which was in line with population growth. And then all of a sudden from 2000 to 2020, ratcheted up to over 2% per year. That's a big increase. And, you know, we also said that those trends are going to continue as we go through this decade. And if you go back and just look at the USDA's WASDE report, which is the World Agricultural Supply Demand report that they put out once a month, that you'll see that since 2019 to today, global grain consumption has grown an additional 6% just those last 3 years. So the thing is, the underlying strong global grain demand trends are continuing. The other side of the potential agricultural crisis that was going to occur was change in weather patterns. And obviously, we're hearing a lot about how adverse weather conditions are affecting huge parts of the world. And it's being, you know, almost universally accredited to global warming and the related global warming climate change. But, you know, we take a little bit of a different view on that. We believe that, you know, we have just started the first part of a global cooling cycle. I know this is very, very contrarian. And, you know, it's not something that a lot of people follow closely. But, you know, you can call me crazy. You can call me out on the fringe. But I'm a big believer that there is a very loose relationship between sunspot cycles and weather patterns. And one of the most interesting things is that the last 20 years, we have been in a very pronounced declining sunspot cycle. And what's so interesting about that is that declining sunspot cycles have often been associated with periods of global cooling. And in periods of global cooling, I should point out, weather patterns become much more disruptive and to global grain producing regions. And that's exactly what we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years. And I think that this is just going to continue as we go through this decade. So you still have very, very strong global grain demand, and that's brought about by the big increases in per capita GDP that's happening in multiple parts of the world, primarily in all the emerging markets. And this global grain boom is bumping up and against very, very adverse weather patterns, and it's going to produce, it's produced the first leg of this crisis, and as we go on and talk in this podcast, it's going to produce other crises as we, you know, go through this decade.
Lee, I want to focus specifically on whether this is over or just starting, because when we had you on a year ago, you were predicting that there would be a bunch of food inflation coming in the future. Well, we have had a lot of food inflation since that interview. I guess a person could make the argument, well, that must mean what Lee was talking about is all over and done with by now. Is that the case, or is it more the case that what you were talking about hasn't even started yet?
No, in fact, I think if you look at the if you were to try to use the analogy of a baseball game to describe this decade of global agricultural crises, so in a 9-inning game, I think that we're only in inning 2 or 3. So we have the rest of the game to play out, and a lot of it is going to have to do with weather related problems. And you know, we've seen it already. We've had, as this decade has started, we've had multiple weather problems. We had a pretty severe drought in Europe last year. We had very adverse weather conditions here in the United States, which caused a very large reduction in total corn acres harvested and a big reduction in estimated corn yields. We had a extremely hot and dry summer in early spring in India last year, which severely impacted their wheat and rice crops. So the thing is that these weather patterns are already emerged, but I think we're only starting this weather problem phenomenon that's going to grip this decade.
Now, one of the most common expressions that you hear on the weather side of this is El Niño. But hang on a second. El Niño is a measure of ocean temperature. Out in the middle of the ocean, what's the temperature of the water at the surface? What does that actually have to do with the price of grains? Why is there this connection?
Well, it's interesting. What the El Niño phenomenon is this oscillation that takes place in the Pacific Ocean, where during the El Niño phase, what you do is you get a very, very warm upwelling of water, warm water, on the west coast of South America. And that is called, you know, that's the El Niño phenomenon. It, conversely, there is the La Niña phenomenon. And the La Niña phenomenon is when you have cold water that presses up against the west coast of South America. Now, these El Niño, La Niña go in cycles. And what drives the switching from the La Niña to the El Niño to the El Niño back to the La Niña, we don't know. And no one really has a very good idea, other than this phenomenon usually happens with differing regularity. But one of the interesting things is that we've been in a relatively strong La Niña for the last 4 years, with classic La Niña effects, in the sense that we've had good La Niña, which traditionally produce very adequate rainfall, Southeast Asia, India, Australia, and will produce much drier conditions in South America and North America. And West Africa will also have moister than normal precipitation trends. Now, when you switch from a La Niña to an El Niño, that all reverses. Southeast Asia, India, Australia will become much drier and be much more prone to drought. West Africa will become much more prone to drought. And North America and South America will become more prone to more precipitation. And those that doesn't mean that this happens every time, but those are the very, very general trends that grip the agricultural world when we switch from La Niña to El Niño and then back again.
Now, you've actually written about Dust Bowl conditions returning at some point. What's that about?
Yeah, this is very interesting. And again, maybe some of your listeners will brand me as a nut or too out on the fringe. But there's some interesting literature written about this, is that within the sunspot cycle, there's a cycle called the Gleisberg cycle. And, you know, Gleisberg existed all the way back in the middle of the last, not the 20th century, the 19th century. And what he noticed is that every 8 solar cycles, and every cycle is 11 years long, is that there's this modulation that takes place in their amplitude. And one of the interesting things is the last occurrence of the Gleisberg cycle happened right in the middle 1930s. And there's a lot of people that believe that the Gleisberg cycle had a lot to do with the incredible drought that gripped the Midwest part of the United States for literally 5 to 6 years and produced the Great Dust Bowl. And for those that like to study this, the 88-year cycle would put if the Dust Bowl really happened between 1934 and 35, that would put the Gleisberg cycle and its impact on the weather into 2023, 2024, which is where we are right now. So what's interesting about this is that if you look at, like, if anyone's curious, you can go on the website and just punch in, or on a browser and punch in U.S. drought monitor, and you will get U.S. drought conditions in the U.S. And if you punch that up today, you will look is at how extremely dry the central part and the eastern part of the United States is. So is this the beginning of the Gleisberg effect on North American weather? Now, here's something else that, like I said, there's a lot of weather phenomenon that's going to occur, that's going to wind up hurting crop yields on a global basis. But another strange effect is that, like I said, we're transitioning now from La Nina to El Nino, which traditionally would mean that we should expect more precipitation in the North American continent. However, this La Nina to El Nino transition is happening where another climatological effect is taking place, and that's called the negative Pacific decadal oscillation. And historically, when you slide from La Nina into El Nino, where the Pacific decadal oscillation is negative, that's produced drought conditions in North America. And the last great episode of that happened in 2012, which was a big drought year in North America, where I should point out, remember, corn yields fell 20% below normal in the U.S., and corn prices hit their all-time, spiked to their all-time highs. So the thing is, are we beginning to see a combination of these effects to grip North America? The fact that we're going from La Nina to El Nino with a negative Pacific decadal oscillation with a Gleisberg overlay on top of the whole thing? Who knows? I mean, maybe this is going to produce really severe drought conditions in North America this growing season. And what's so interesting is that, like I said, if anyone's interested, go punch out U.S. Drought Monitor, and it will show you the very, very strong levels of dryness, near drought conditions that are gripping large parts of the United States today. So the thing is that this is just another series of weather events that seem to be cropping up that will make, could potentially cause the next great global agricultural crisis.
Lee, I want to make sure that I understand the drivers of this, because before we were talking about a demand-driven scenario where there's going to be more people in emerging market economies that are able to afford proteins and not just grains. So people who used to eat rice are going to start eating meat, and that's going to demand a whole lot of grains. And just for anyone who's not seeing that exponential connection there, every bit of meat was fed by eating grains. So when you eat meat as a human, you're eating a whole lot of rice. It's all of the rice that the animal ate, and it adds up. That was one explanation. Now we're talking about a weather situation, which is much more of a supply-side disruption, which I would hope would be somewhat temporary. Is it both of these things at once? In other words, do we have a problem if it turns out the weather's okay? Do we still have a problem with the supply-demand imbalance around grains? Or is this mostly weather-driven? How do I balance this in my mind as to how much of it is weather and how much of it isn't?
Well, that's why, in some ways, that's why I have great confidence of talking about this decade will be, one of rolling agricultural crises, because it's both. As I mentioned earlier in the podcast, Eric, that since 2019, global grain consumption has grown, by 6% in just basically 3 years. And the thing is that you've got this very, very strong underlying demand for grain based upon people switching over to a protein-based diet. And it's now, it's that strong demand is colliding, bumping up against a situation where supply of grain is going to become much more uncertain. And, you know, one of the reasons why from 2000 to 2020 is that, you know, we had, you know, big surges in grain prices, and there was some problems. I mentioned before the drought of 2012, and there were other demand responses like the change from going E5 to E10 ethanol content back in 2004, 5, and 6, which added a huge amount of demand for grain, that weather conditions were very, very good during that most of that time period, and global grain production was able to meet all that big ratcheting up in demand. That ratcheting up in demand is still taking place today, and now it's bumping up against supply problems. So it's both demand and supply basically bumping up against each other, which means we're going to have these big, huge price spikes in grain markets as we travel through this decade.
Tell me more about those price spikes and what's going to drive them. Are there some grains that are much more sensitive to weather and other factors? Is there a way for us to know which markets are going to be most heavily affected?
They're all going to be affected, but there's good. You know, it's so funny. You mentioned food inflation. One of the interesting areas where we're going to potentially see a lot of food inflation is in both, you know, the cocoa markets, which obviously cocoa is used to make chocolate, and sugar and coffee. Which, you know, we sort of forget, you know, when we think of coffee, we think of Brazil. But it's funny, I was just checking on this. It turns out that Vietnam is the world's second largest coffee producer. Indonesia is the fourth largest coffee producer. And India is the seventh largest coffee producer. And all those countries are going to be countries that are going to be affected by the El Nino potential drought conditions. Remember, I said Southeast Asia. That's where drought usually begins to form during an El Nino. Now, the thing is, like cocoa, obviously, that primarily that's going to be that's mostly from West Africa. But the funny thing is, West Africa in an El Nino situation also suffers a high probability for drought as well. So there's going to be those commodities are those soft commodities are going to potentially experience price spikes. But, you know, if we do have a drought condition emerge here in the United States this summer, then it would be corn and soybeans. They would definitely be the commodities that would be primarily affected and would undergo severe upward price pressure. Just to show you how sensitive, you know, like the corn market would be, you know, the USDA has come out with its projections for the 2023-2024 growing season, and that corn crop is now in the ground and growing. And they believe that, you know, that basically we're going to harvest, you know, 4 or 5 million acres more corn this year, with a record yield of almost 182 bushels per acre. Now, those are very, very optimistic numbers given how dry it's already begun. But if we were to go back to the harvest levels that we had last year, because we originally reduced the corn harvest by about 5 million acres because of extra dry conditions, and the yield fell all the way down from about 182 all the way down to 173, and that brought what they call the corn carryout inventory, which is that's the corn in inventory before the next year corn crops grows in 2024. That brought it down not to record lowers, but pretty very low. If those numbers that I just put forward come have and we drop 5 million of corn acres and we go back to like a 175 yield, then all of a sudden that we go down to just corn carryout levels that are near record lows and would wind up producing huge upward pressure on price. So, the global agricultural crisis and the upward price pressure on grains is going to manifest itself in a lot of different agricultural commodities.
Let's come back to cocoa for a minute, because that's a commodity that right now is kind of through the roof on prices. I'm not sure what the driver is. I mean, we got a pandemic and you know, there's been compromised supply chains, but most of that is behind us. Cocoa is not semiconductors from Taiwan that are, you know, essentially needed to make missile parts. It's a luxury. You would think that this would be a commodity that we wouldn't be experiencing a shortage with, but we seem to be. Why is that?
Yeah, again, but it's a perfect commodity to explain the phenomenon, Eric, that we talked about. You said it's a luxury good, and it is, in the sense that, you know, most people, poor people in the world, can't afford chocolate. But the thing is if you're a Chinese consumer and a decade ago your per capita GDP was $500 annually, and now that per capita GDP is $5,000, you've sort of developed a sweet tooth for cocoa, for chocolate. And so that's the type of upside demand pressure that we're seeing. And the second is that, you know, West Africa, like I mentioned, if we're switching from a La Nina to an El Nino, one of the areas that is going to be of a high susceptibility to drought is going to be West Africa, the prime cocoa growing region of the world. And I think this could be a poster child for strong demand colliding with a supply problem that's weather related.
I want to come back to the timing of all of this and how much of it is really happening already and how much is still to come, because a lot of people are looking at the food price inflation that's already occurred and said, okay, we've got a crisis in our hands. This is really big. This is the big one. It sounds to me like what you're saying is, no, the crisis hasn't even started yet.
And so far, I think that's right. And I think that it's going to be, the crisis that has existed for the world, in the U.S. and in Europe and in the high-income countries, we've been annoyed by food inflation. You know, it's something that we've had to deal with. We find it very, very annoying. And for various income levels, it's definitely put a crimp on disposable income and what you have. But there's very large parts of the world that are where people are suffering severe caloric deficits, in places like some places in Southeast Asia, some places throughout Africa. And so, you know, the crisis of pure hunger is gripping areas that are far from our field of vision. However, you know, my gut feel is that if we're headed to this much more severe problem, then all of a sudden, you know, it will, first, food inflation will probably get a lot worse. And, it'll be driven by trends that have already emerged but have stopped getting press attention. You know, when right after Russia invaded Ukraine, we had our first bout of what's called food nationalism that the world hasn't seen since the 1970s. And when I talk about food nationalism, what is that? It's when, say, for example, if you're India and you're a big wheat consumer and a big wheat exporter, in order to protect your population from the high price of wheat, which, remember, wheat prices spiked big after the Ukrainian invasion, that what do? You ban exports. And that way you basically try to bring down domestic prices. But by banning exports, for example, we all forget, you know, India is a huge participant on global wheat export markets. Off the top of my head, I think they represent close to 10% of global wheat exports, which is very similar to Ukraine. And what's interesting is that when you ban those exports, you tighten up the food chain in other places of the world. So, you know, food nationalism, and we had multiple aspects of it. I mean, Indonesia banned the export of palm oil. India banned wheat, rice, and sugar in the drought period they had last year. And so food nationalism will be thrown on top of the standard supply-demand balances that are there as governments step in to try to protect their indigenous populations and shield them from super high prices. So all this lies in front of us. And, you know, it's so funny. As somebody who grew up in the 70s, I vividly remember that, you know, there were periods where at one point there was a meat shortage in America, where, you know, especially after Nixon did that big surprise export of wheat to Russia, there was panic in the global grain markets for weeks and weeks. There was huge upward pressure in price, ultimately resulting in a shortage of meat in supermarkets at the point in the mid-70s. So, you know, could we begin to see that as well? I mean, we are seeing it now. You know, for example, there's a coffee bean shortage taking place. And, you know, there's a lot of talk that supermarkets in many grades of coffee are now unavailable. So we should expect to see things like this emerge in the next crisis. Eric, you answered an interesting question. Is timing? Obviously, predicting weather patterns is very, very difficult to do. And you know, I consider myself an amateur meteorologist, so I know how fiendishly hard it is. But I think the thing is, you just have to watch it. Like I said, we have near drought conditions across large swaths of the United States today. And we'll just have to follow weather patterns. If for example, you know, that they switch to a dry, hot pattern, which now seems to be gripping Texas, if that begins to migrate northward up into the central part of the United States, then a lot of what I just said could very well be happening. So it's one of those things we're just going to have to monitor. But I think that between now and year end, we could see one of these events that I'm talking about begin to actually grip various agricultural markets.
Let's talk about the Ukraine conflict and how it changes the global landscape of commodity trading, because it seems to me that this is not going to end anytime soon. I don't think this conflict is really just about Ukraine and Russia. I think it's the beginning of a much larger trend, a conflict of the superpowers, where we're going to see more and more geopolitical tension in the world. If I'm right about that, it seems to me that you have what really is a very global commodity market today. We trade things pretty openly with just about everybody. If that closes back down to what we had in the Cold War, where the East and the West don't trade with each other, what are the implications of that? And what do the potential knock-on effects look like?
Russia's invasion of the Ukraine is still severely affecting global grain markets. Here's just some statistics. You know, obviously, Ukraine is a huge wheat exporter. You know, at their peak in their 2020 to 2021 growing season, Ukraine exported about 33 million tons of wheat, which represented about 10% of the entire global wheat export market. This year, the USDA is estimating that they will only export 17 million tons of wheat into the 2023-2024 agriculture year. That's down 50%. That's a lot. And corn, it's basically the same way. You know, basically, Ukraine's corn exports peaked at about 30 million tons at the end of last decade. And this year, the USDA estimates they'll be about 19 million tons. They're down almost 40% from their peak. And, you know, Ukraine corn exports represent 5% of global corn export market. So the Ukraine situation, as far as their ability to export, emerged as an issue last year, and it's going to continue to be an issue going forward into 2023, 2024. And you're right, you know, we have become a world where obviously we're, because of globalization, global grain markets have become completely globalized, which is something very different than we had back in the 1970s. And so the thing is that will food become a huge source of geopolitical conflict going forward? Where could it emerge? It's questions I really don't know, but the switch from a unipolar to a multipolar world and the fragmentation of globalization is definitely going to have a negative impact on global agricultural markets, and which means higher prices.
Let's shift gears now and translate this discussion into how it actually relates to trades we can place in the market. If you hold these views, and I would summarize your view as to say that really for the rest of this decade, we're likely to have a series of agricultural crises, and it's hard to tell exactly when they're going to happen and what the details are going to be, but there's going to be plenty of them coming. What do you do? Do you just hold a basket of agricultural commodities with kind of a buy and hold and roll them every month and call it good? Or do you try to time in and out of the market with what you think is going to happen next as you follow the weather patterns? How do you actually trade markets to reflect these views?
Well, I think at the last podcast, I think you and I talked about this, Eric. I think I mentioned that one of my favorite ways to play it was with the fertilizer stocks. You know, obviously, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has severely disrupted the movement of fertilizers, because you remember Russia is one of the world's largest potash producers and exporters, and it's also an extremely large phosphate exporter. And so the thing is that many of those fertilizer prices had huge price spikes in 2022, literally almost tripling in between the beginning part of 2022 to the summer of 2022. Those fertilizer prices have given back a large part of those gains that was obviously brought about by panic buying. However, you know, fertilizer prices are still about 50-60% higher than they were back in the end of 2000. 18, 2019, 2020. And fertilizer equities have pulled back significantly as well. And I think that one should buy, you know, buy a portfolio of various fertilizer, high quality fertilizer producers. You know, I usually don't recommend stocks on programs like this, but, you know, stocks like Mosaic, MOS, Nutrient, NTR, these stocks have pulled back 40-50% from their highs and now offer what I believe is high levels of value. And I think that, you know, when grape prices go up, fertilizer prices go up, and the earnings of these companies will go up. And I feel that the pullbacks here have given potential agricultural investors another great buying opportunity.
And I should mention for anyone who missed your last interview that the fertilizer story ties into natural gas prices and everything else. So if you haven't heard that whole analysis of why fertilizer prices are probably headed higher, you'll want to check Lee's interview from last year here on Macro Voices. Lee, tell us a little bit more about, aside from fertilizer, where you think this is headed and what the time frame is. It sounds like you think the rest of the decade is the time frame for higher agricultural prices. If I think about, you know, the way these commodities, the food chain, if you will, the meats are all eating the grains. So I suppose there's a leverage factor that the price of beef is going to go up exponentially with the price of whatever grain the beef is eating. If I want to invest in these things, do you invest in the grains themselves? Because that's really where the tension is. Or do you invest in the things that eat the grains? Because there's leverage there.
Well, it's interesting. The whole cattle cycle is very, very different than the grain cycle. In the sense, usually what happens is that they're and many times they're inversely correlated. For example, when you have a big, huge spike in grain prices, what happens is that feedlots all of a sudden are now experiencing a negative margin. They are selling to the cattle at today's price, and their input costs, their grain prices, have gone up a lot. What does that cause feedlots and ranchers to do? They sell their cattle because they just can't afford to hold them. So you'll often get a situation where as you get this big, huge bull market in grain, you'll get a bear market in cattle because there's a huge liquidation that takes place. Now, on a longer-term basis, those cattle herds will have to be rebuilt. So that produces the next bull market in cattle prices. So I don't recommend anyone to play the livestock market. It's too complicated, and there's got a lot of variables which are, in many ways, to the average investor, are even counterintuitive and things like that. So I would say, you know, don't become, unless you really want to live life on the edge, don't speculate in cattle futures. But, you know, it's just they will be between I have a great belief that by the end of this decade, cattle prices will be a lot higher than they are now, just like grain prices will be higher, fertilizer prices will be higher, and cropland will be higher.
It sounds like you prefer plays on fertilizer as opposed to direct plays on the commodities themselves. Any particular reason?
Well, if somebody I should point out that I own a relatively large farm. And we raise cattle. And, you know, it's funny, if you watch the movie Yellowstone, there's a lot of, obviously, other elements going on in there. But it does talk about, you know, the tremendous amount of work and difficulties that go into managing a farm. It requires a certain type of personality. It requires a certain skill set. And it requires, I'm almost going to say a level of fortitude, because there's so much against you. You know, the weather's against you. The governments are against you. The big food companies are against you, and it's a hard way to make a living. However, you know, if you want to invest farmland, now it turns out there's a couple, I'm not going to actually recommend names, but there are a couple publicly traded farmland REITs that trade on the New York Stock Exchange. So if anyone's interested in owning farmland on a relatively easy way to do it, they could be potential investments for you. But the fertilizers are easy, they pay dividends, as opposed to going out and becoming investing in cattle futures or going out and buying farmland directly, which I don't, unless you have, you really want to get drawn into this area, I don't recommend anyone to really do.
Lee, we've been talking specifically about grains and about the food inflation that we both expect to come, but your company actually does a lot of commodity research, not just grains. So let's expand the conversation now to commodities more broadly. We've been talking about the grain investments. Is that your favorite investment right now, or are there other commodity plays that you find interesting? And if so, what are they?
Interesting question, Eric. There are, you know, people ask me, you know, what are you bullish on short term? And because we always have a tendency to fall back and we say, well, no, on a long-term basis, I'm bullish on this. But here are two commodities that I'm very bullish on short term. One is U.S. natural gas. You know, we're a big believer that because of the underlying changes that are taking place in the supply dynamic here in the United States, that the U.S. natural gas market is on the verge of swinging from what I call structural surplus to structural deficit. And one of the big ramifications of swinging from structural surplus to structural deficit is that U.S. natural gas prices are going to converge with international gas prices. So today, U.S. gas prices are $2.60, $2.70. International gas prices, like the European natural gas price, is basically almost $13. And so, and the strip is even higher. The strip is well over 20. So the thing is that once that we go from structural surplus to structural deficit, we could, and the mechanism to take advantage of that arbitrage is in place, which is the U.S. LNG export business, which we're expanding. We're going to add another 6 BCF of export capacity in 2024, that we will see a convergence in the price. So gas prices going from $2.50 or $2.60 up to $13, that could happen within the next 6 months. So that would be my number one commodity that I believe is has the best short-term potential. The other commodity is, again, it's a funny commodity because most people don't follow it, is uranium. And I believe that, you know, the uranium is been in a bull market, but since we really don't, it's not a listed market that we follow. There's not a lot of, they don't talk about it on CNBC and things like that. But, you know, uranium prices have really, they started the year basically at $48, $49, and they're basically up to $56, $57 today. So they're moving nicely. And on a short-term basis, there's going to be a phenomenon that happens in the uranium market. And mind you, individual investors can participate in the spot uranium price. There is a vehicle out there, the Sprott Uranium Trust. It follows the spot uranium prices. If you would like to participate in that bull market, you know, call your broker. He can buy that for you. Trades in Toronto. But the Sprott Uranium Trust, once it's a closed-end trust, it trades at discounts and premiums to its net asset value. Since the beginning part of the year, it's been at a discount. And that prevents them from issuing new shares and going out and buying uranium in the spot market. However, that discount has been narrowing, and I think my gut feel is that we're going to swing from the Sprott Uranium Trust trading at a discount to trading it. It will begin to trade at a premium. When it trades at a premium, it's going to issue new shares and it's going to go into the spot market to buy spot uranium. At the same time that utilities are beginning to really get worried about being able to cover their uranium needs between now and the next 7 to 8 years. So I believe that we could see a chaotic uranium market develop in the next 6 months as the Sprott Uranium Trust competes with actual commercial uranium buyers, that primarily utilities, to fulfill their needs. So that's a commodity that I'm very, very bullish on a short-term basis. And there's, like I said, there's a way for investors, retail investors, to play it.
And of course, that ticker symbol is U.UN for the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. Lee, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, tell us a little bit more about what you do at Gehring and Rosenzweig. Specifically, a lot of people think you guys are an institutional commodity research firm because you write a lot of excellent reports. That's not actually your core business, is it?
No, we are an SEC registered firm. We manage a mutual fund, the Gehring and Rosenzweig Resources Fund, which is GRGRHIX. It's available. It's open to everyone. I think a minimal investment in the retail class is only $3,000. So you can invest with us using that vehicle. And we manage a bunch of institutional accounts as well. Like you said, Eric, we're well known for our research. It's part of our investment process. You know, when Adam and I've been writing research on global commodity markets now for 25 years. And most of the places that I've worked at, it was not put in the public domain. When Adam and I established Gehring and Rosenzweig back in the first quarter of 2016, we said, let's put our research into the public domain. It's really good stuff. It's traditionally always found a huge level of investor interest. And we've done that. And it's exploded. It's everywhere. And it's a lot of really, really good research. But one of the things that our investors should know is that we use that research as the basis for our investment. And, you know, we're 100% research driven. And, you know, we're not trend followers. We're willing to get involved in, you know, commodity markets that have gone through severe bear markets where everyone is bearish and all the securities that are in that area of the commodity market are selling at incredibly distressed prices, no buyers. We're willing to get involved in those type of areas. And that's because of our research. We have great confidence that our research is able to pick out trends that most investors miss. And so we combine the research, which is in the public domain, everyone can read it, but it's the basis for our investment process.
The research is free at gorosen.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out information on the fund offerings as well. Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, great interview with Lee. Now, joining us in the postgame segment is Nick Galarnik. Now, let's get to the chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link for the postgame chart deck in the Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the button over Lee's picture that says, looking for the downloads. All right, Eric, let's jump into page two. We have crude oil. What are you thinking?
EIA inventory was delayed by the Juneteenth holiday, so I don't have it this week. We've now bounced $7 off the lows, meaning that it's time to find out whether this rally has legs or if it's going to roll over like the last 14 rallies in crude oil did. I'll turn bullish above the 100-day moving average at 74.69 on WTI. But until we get there, I'm a skeptic only because of recent market weakness. I have been on board for quite a long time that when we start to challenge the limits of supply, prices are going to go through the roof. It seems like the market has been mostly focused on demand weakness as opposed to supply constraints. As long as that's the case, we're going to keep seeing these low prices. So I'm waiting to weather the recession is coming storm. We'll see what happens there. So I don't know if we're going lower first, but eventually I expect much higher crude oil prices.
Yeah, Eric, when we're looking at that chart, while it looks like we were up a large amount by percentage, technically, there hasn't been nothing significant that's happened in my mind. We still have a very important trade range that's in that $75 to $80 area that I, in my mind, view as the neutral zone on oil, which is the bulls have to essentially get it back up into those ranges to basically undo the prevailing downtrend that's been dominant for over a year, the sequential period of lower highs and lower lows and descending trend lines and below all the major averages. And we really need to see that downtrend broken in order for the bulls to have a chance. And really at this moment, we have not seen bullish price action yet. And if oil rolls over here, it's still vulnerable for retesting lows. And even under the right bearish conditions can even have a quick trip to 60, even though that's not necessarily what I'm anticipating. Point is that the bulls have a lot of work ahead of them still to turn this chart higher. Nonetheless, let's move on to equities. Eric, what are you thinking on this B here?
Despite the pullback early this week, the fact remains that the S&P broke out decisively above its 61.8% Fib retracement level, and it remains well above that level right now. This leaves me with what I call crossed circuits. On one hand, I couldn't possibly agree more with the very smart guests who have warned us that the bottom is not yet in for this bear market. They make excellent fundamental arguments, and I agree with them. But there regularly comes a time in every fundamental analyst's career where the market is telling you that your view is just plain wrong. This market needs to either collapse back down below 4309 and stay there, or else the technical signal is very clear. It says we're headed toward new all-time highs. Because the new technical signal directly contradicts what seems to me like bulletproof logic and reason with a more bearish fundamental view, I'm on the sidelines and plan to stay there. In the interest of full disclosure, I did try shorting this market, first at 4309 and then adding to it at 4360. I've subsequently been stopped out of that trade. You can't win them all. You win some and you lose some. I'm just waiting to see what happens. But if this rally continues from here, it really says to me that something's wrong with the fundamental view that I've been believing, because it's really not supposed to play this way unless the bear market really is ending. And I'm having a hard time believing that.
All right, Nick, I want to get you in the conversation because I know you're watching the S&P levels. What are the option levels you're watching?
Spot price right now is 4365 on SPX. We have a call wall above at 4500 and a put wall below at 4000, which is also key support. Now, the implied move for the July 21st OPEX is 115 points in either direction. So the upper expected move is 4480, just below that call wall. And the lower expected move is 4250, which is also another support level. Again, key resistance above is at 4400 now. Key support below is at 4300, 4250, 4200, and then 4000. I'm inclined to think that we see some sideways action perhaps into the July monthly OPEX. I also think we retest the highs, but I do think that we test out the 4320 level, which is also the JP Morgan caller level for next Friday's June 30th OPEX.
Nick, it's interesting that you highlighted that JP Morgan wheel, because that's sort of what's on my mind here. Obviously, the magnet on the gamma magnet is at the 4320 level. And I think that that's really going to be the story for the rest of June, which is essentially we had this big punch higher on the June expiry gamma squeeze. And now that much of that June expiry gamma has been rolled off, we now have a scenario where the markets are just going to mean revert and consolidate. It doesn't mean that into July we can't have another bullish impulse or some other type of a more volatile move. But really, for the next week or so, going into that June 30th, it really is likely that we're just going to mean revert back toward the 50-day moving average. I have it on page 4 and consolidate in the zone. And that's really, I think, going to be more of the story of the summer, which is maybe we go and retest the highs, we kind of bounce around, and probably whether it's the July earnings or maybe one of the jobs numbers in July or August, or maybe it pushes out to something like the Jackson Hole event, but inevitably there's going to be a catalyst that is going to drive the next major trend move in the markets. But on the short term, it's possible that we're going to at least start the summer in some sort of a consolidation mode. Nonetheless, on page 5, we have the QQQs. What are you watching here on the NASDAQ?
The spot price right now on Qs is 362. We have a call wall above at 370 and a put wall below at 350. And the implied move for the July 21st OPEX is plus minus 15 points. So the upper expected move is 377 and the lower expected move is 347. Key resistance is above at 372, which is also the high from March of 2022. And key support is at 335. Now, again, I think that some tech names are pretty frothy right now, namely NVIDIA and Tesla. Tesla's already pulled about 26 points off of their highs in the last couple of days, but they've gained about $350 billion in market cap over the last month. So I think they're going to cool off for a bit. And as we've stated in the past, having, you know, 7-8 names carry the weight of the market typically doesn't bode well when those names roll over a little bit or stagnate. So if we see NVIDIA and Tesla, among others, roll over, it's probable we're going to see a testing of the recent lows, perhaps. Like, not the lows for the past year, but I'm talking the 350 levels, 340 levels kind of thing. And that support area of 332 is very, very important. If we break below that, then it's possible we go back down to around 300 level, which is about 20% or so below the current price on the Qs. Now, I want to move on to the VIX on page 6 here. We're seeing new lows, new multi-year lows on the VIX, which is kind of interesting to see because we're seeing a pulling off of the recent highs. And you'd think that a decline in the market would coincide with a spike in the VIX, but that hasn't happened yet. So interesting to watch. Even yesterday when Powell was speaking in his testimony, the VIX was going down even as the market declined a little bit. So very interesting action to see right now. Again, with the VIX at around 13, 14, expected moves each day in the broad markets are about 0.8% or so. And we're seeing for the past couple of days that we've actually exceeded that at some points during the intraday market trading.
Interesting observation, Nick, because it's exactly that. There's clearly no imbalance in buying that is driving volatility premiums higher. And it maybe is demonstrating some complacency. But what is interesting on page 7, just overlaid the VIX with the VVIX, which is the volatility levels on the VIX itself when buying options. And so what you can see is that they are actually trading back up to April and May highs, which means that option premiums on the volatility are actually still being priced with a little bit extra premium. Maybe the market, while complacent right now, is messaging that some volatility is coming. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out once we get past that June 30th window.
Now on page 8, we have the US dollar index. What are your thoughts here?
No real change from last week. We're right in the middle of a wide consolidation zone. Only a daily close below 100 or above 105 would change that, in my opinion.
Eric, that trade range is exactly dominant. But what is interesting to me is the divergence between Asian currencies versus Western world currencies, right? So while the Australian dollar has been somewhat okay, but the Canadian dollar, euro, and the pound have been incredibly strong. But when you look at the US dollar relative to the yen or the US dollar relative to the renminbi, they're moving the exact opposite direction. And there's these cross currents between the currencies. It'll be interesting whether or not they all converge and start to trend, because so long as that divergence exists, I think that the trade range will prevail. Ultimately, any US dollar bull impulses likely need some sort of economic cracks. And right now, it just doesn't feel like that is what the market is worried about. So let's see how that develops.
Now on page 9, we have the gold futures chart. Eric, what are your thoughts here?
As I've been warning for the last couple of weeks, I think gold is poised for a deeper correction than we've seen so far. Last week saw the first daily close below channel support, and this Tuesday marked the first daily close below the 100-day moving average on the continuation chart. Meanwhile, Jay Powell is telling lawmakers that the fight against inflation is far from over. That means more rate hikes are coming. While at the same time, the dot plot predicts two more 25 basis point hikes in calendar 23. All these things perfectly set the stage for gold to make a deeper correction as the Fed continues to hike rates to fight inflation. When everything eventually breaks, and breaks badly, the Fed will start cutting aggressively despite the fact that inflation is still raging, and gold will soar. But until then, a soft patch for the yellow metal makes perfect sense on both technical and fundamental levels. My downside target is $1,860, which is almost $80 lower than the market was trading on Wednesday evening.
Eric, what's interesting to me is that up until April and May, the correlation of gold to something like the euro has worked very well, which is essentially gold has behaved like a cross currency to the US dollar. But what we've really seen at this stage is the euro and a bunch of these other currencies strengthen and the US dollar weaken, but yet it has made almost little to no impact on the price action of gold. And so this is a really interesting divergence. Right now, gold is behaving very much like it's being distributed, and it's coming to that key Fib level. So it'll be really interesting to see whether this kind of 1925 to 1950 zone holds this consolidation. And you're bang on. I mean, if we see a break of the May lows really hold, 1850 or even the lows of March near 1800 unfortunately become short-term targets. I remain big picture bullish gold, but we're clearly in some sort of a consolidation and at some very key support levels. Nonetheless, I wanted to wrap up this week by talking about the grains, since Lee talked about it in the interview. I start off here with the wheat chart. And what's amazing is what happened just this week in the grain markets. We've been, since October of last year, in a very clear downwards channel of lower highs and lower lows, and a clear downtrend that has wiped out, 30-40% of the value of wheat prices. And what we've seen this week was a legitimate bull breakout in wheat. And it basically in 4 days wiped out several months of price action on the downside, and decisively advertising a potential new bull breakout. This will be really interesting to see whether or not this is actually a turn point in what's been a very distinct 9 month bear market. On page 11, I have the Invesco Agricultural Fund ETF, symbol DBA, which is a basket of agricultural commodity futures. And what you can see is that this is very distinctly bullishly breaking out. And we continue to see the agricultural space actually doing very well. And not many people are talking about it. And one of the reasons on page 12, when you look at the ag business ETF, which is the symbol MOO, which is the all those nutrients and mosaics of the world, they have been in a very distinct bear market and really have not begun to bull trend yet. The interesting question is, are we going to see the agricultural stocks finally come to life and start to trend the way it looks like that the futures are currently doing?
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
In the Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, the chart book we just discussed here in the postgame, and a number of links to articles that we found interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that is Eric spelled with a K, and follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.